Michael Nicholson, Reel 33.
Sir, you're in David Nicholas. I said, we've got this great story. Navy won't give us a helicopter. By the time we get it out, it'll be history. He said, what do you think I should do? I said, ring the First Sea Lord. So he said, well, I don't have his telephone number. I said, I do. So David rang this First Sea Lord at home and told him what had happened. And it was Lewin, and Admiral Lewin, who said, well, of course, I can't interfere with the operations in the Gulf. He said, but I'll ring up and see how they're getting on. Just a call. Of course, he must have mentioned to the Commodore, recalcitrant Commodore, oh, I hear you've got some wonderful pictures today of this attack. Looking forward to seeing them. And the Commodore got the message. So within 5 minutes, there was a helicopter on deck, and the film video went back to Bahrain. But the Commodore was not pleased and said, do that again and you're out. Of course, he wouldn't have dared. But that's the kind of things that's the kind of thing you have to do sometimes to twist people's arms. I'm looking at my diary again, and it is Saturday, 23rd of February. And of course, we don't know what's going on, do we, on land? All we can see now, because we're pretty close to the Kuwaiti coast, so close in fact we can see the oil fires burning with our binoculars. I suppose we must have been 10 miles from the coast. Couldn't go any closer because the minesweepers hadn't gone that close. So we had to keep that far away. But we could see that at least one of Saddam's promises had come true, that he would set fire to the oil wells, and the sky was black. You'd get a better description from the guys in the desert, but all we could see was black. And although the sun was out, as it always was every day in the Gulf, it wasn't out that day. It was like being in a grey English November morning. In fact, blacker than that. It was as if the sun had gone forever. It was quite an astonishing sight. It was apocalypse now, the end of the world. And that evening I transmitted what I thought must be my last broadcast of the war. The war was over, according to what we were listening on the radio. And I transmitted to ITN, we are within sight of Kuwait City, so close this ship's video cameras are recording the damaged buildings along the seafront and the wreckage in the harbour. My information is that the last of the Iraqi forces have fled the capital, and the destruction they leave behind them is far worse than anyone had expected. Much damage has been done by Allied bombing and shelling, but I can confirm that the Iraqis have set fire to 100 or more oil wells, and since sunset the city has been glowing red, and the entire coastline seems to be on fire. All day, the giant American battleships, Wisconsin and Missouri, have been pounding the shore with their 16-inch guns. And as I speak, the night sky is orange with their blasts. We are waiting a little anxiously for news that the Iraqi silkworm missile sites are now safely in Allied hands. Our ships are now very close to shore. It would be nice to know they're no longer there. But anyway, we soon found out, because the next morning, Wednesday the 27th, I was woken by the red alert siren, followed by two enormous blasts. My little cabin, if cabin it was the luggage room, and the bulkhead behind me actually shook. God, we've been hit. And you know, we weren't in pyjamas in those days. You went to sleep dressed, and pulled on my shoes and rushed out, expecting the worst. Grabbed my gas mask, life jacket, and I ran for the steps that led to the bridge. Everyone was running, and it was action stations, red alert. But by the time I got to the bridge, it was all over. The last of the Iraqi silkworms had been fired at our ship. But thank God, a very alert guy down in the ops room, watching radar and watching any blip coming from the shore, had seen it and had sounded the alarm. And within seconds of it being fired, apparently, we knew it was on its way. Now, that thing travels, the silkworm travels at about 600 miles an hour. Yeah, and we weren't many miles from the coast. And I'm told when it hits you, it's like being hit by a double-decker bus. You know, destroyers aren't big ships. And modern-day destroyers have very thin hulls. And had we been hit by the silkworm, it would have split us into two. It would have split us into two. And we would have sunk, you know, very quickly afterwards. But the self... this missile has a self-locking, a self-guiding radar system. And it hadn't locked onto our target properly. But we launched our Sea Dart missiles. That was the two bangs I heard. And it hit the silkworm when it was only 4 miles away. It would have missed us, we gather, looking at its trajectory, but it would have hit Missouri, the American battleship. It wouldn't have sunk Missouri, but it would have caused many deaths. So the Americans were indebted to us. That young 19-year-old kid in the ops room, by his alertness and reaction, certainly saved many, many lives, American lives. Wilcox, the captain, who had been asleep in his bunk, told me that it had taken exactly 17 seconds from the moment the silkworm was launched to him running down into the ops room and giving the order for our sea darts to be launched. Amazing. And I've written in again in my diary that the mysterious war was not over, because having survived that silkworm, they were very jittery after that, of course. And that evening, one of the American destroyers in the convoy with the battleships went on red alert, having detected, or so it thought, another incoming missile. And they send out chaff, you know, we release chaff. It's little casings full of aluminium foil, and you throw it into the air, and that aluminium foil attracts the missile to it rather than to the ship itself. But the gunners on deck was so confused, having not been told about what was happening, heard this whoosh, and they opened fire with their 20mm guns, and they hit Missouri. They sprayed Missouri nearby, and it was a miracle that nobody was killed. I think that's it.
It would be interesting to know, you know, this would have been 10 years after, almost 10 years after, the Falklands. Had warfare changed that much? You know, was this a different sort of war to anything hitherto, would you say?
Well, for me, it was much the same in respect that, you know, I spent a lot of time on a ship in the Falklands, various ships, Fearless, you know, of course, was the one in which we were in San Carlos water when we were under attack. And I was aboard a ship for all the time I was in the Gulf. So I was, in many ways, it was similar to me because, you know, much the same routine, red alerts, tannoy, you know, action station, blah, blah, blah of the alarm. All the training we did was very helpful once we were in the Gulf. So in that respect, it was very similar. But in all other respects, of course, it was different, because in the Falklands I went from ship to land and experienced two aspects of war, whereas in the Gulf I remained on ship. And all the information that I gleaned about what was going on inland was what you at home were hearing. I only heard it on the radio. Now, as far as technology was concerned, well, you know, both ends of the scale, we were sitting alongside Wisconsin and Missouri, who were built and fought in the Second World War, and at the same time they were launching the latest in technology, the Tomahawk, that could, you know, find its own way to a target. You know, we were like the Second World War, we had machine guns on board, a Hurricane gun. But at the same time, we had the latest in missile technology, the Sea Dart. We had helicopter on board that we were attacking with skewers. The technique of war was much the same, wasn't it? It never changes. But the technology of war advances itself. God knows what will happen in the next one. I think the whole movement nowadays in war is to remove man from it and let his machines do the killing. If we are going to have another war in Iraq, I doubt if it'll be done by men anymore. You know, there used to be a little joke that in the next war, instead of sending your infantry and tanks, just put the generals in a room and let them fight it out together. And I think in the next war, the movement towards removing men and human casualties from it will be enormous, and it will be done from 45,000 feet or from 500 miles with missiles. You kill men with your machines, not with your own men, because you won't have body bags then. That's what scares the Americans enormously. It's body bags.
So will you be going to the next war, Michael?
Well, I suppose the short answer is I'm already visaed up to go to the next war. We're already visaed up with Iraqi visas. I mean, if I go, it'll be probably on the wrong side. It'll be on the Iraqi side. This is the astonishing thing about war nowadays, isn't it? You can actually go and live with the enemy. In the Falklands, of course, I didn't, but in so many cases I do. For example, in Israel, if I go and cover the conflict in Israel, I can be with the Israeli soldiers one day and the next day be under fire from the Israelis because I'm sitting with the Palestinians. It was the same in Africa. You know, my very first war, 1 month I'm with the Nigerian Federal Army killing Biafrans, and a few weeks after that I'm with the Biafrans trying to kill Nigerians. It was the same in the Falklands, not with me, but you know, we had British reporters in Buenos Aires. At the same time, we had British reporters with the task force. It's odd that countries need us with them. Saddam Hussein, in a way, needed foreign journalists in Baghdad, and he will need foreign journalists in Baghdad in the next war. Because one of the things that upsets British viewers, and I suppose American viewers too, is to see civilian casualties caused by British and American bombing. And it helps Iraqi propaganda to have us there to report these things.
Is that any dilemma for you, you know, to actually be there reporting from the Iraqi side?
The only dilemma is that I might get killed. No, I mean, my job is not to take sides in this. I mean, as much as we all loathe Saddam Hussein, it seems terribly unfair to kill a lot of innocent Iraqis in order to get rid of him. I know we had to do that with Hitler, but then, you know, that was a different kind of war for a different kind of reason. I mean, the Gulf War in 1991 was a Gulf war to save oil, to protect our oil. This Gulf War is about exactly the same thing. This is not simply to get rid of a dictator. It is to protect oil fields so that the West can be guaranteed safe supplies of oil. That's what all this is about. And then that's uppermost in your mind, and would be if you were to suddenly see a hospital in which 500 kids or 300 adults or whatever have been slaughtered by B-52 bombing. You would think, you know, why are we killing, or should we be killing, innocents simply to protect our cars and our oil fields? Their oil fields, but our oil, because we buy it. It's a cynic's attitude to it, but it is a realistic cynic's attitude to it.
So having gone through and survived the Gulf War, and you know, you've just mentioned you're anticipating going to the next one, if indeed there is a war. What makes you want to do this, Michael? You know, to risk your life?
Yes, that question must have been asked me 1,000 times, and you'd have thought by now I would have worked out a glib answer. But there is no answer. If I can remind you of a famous film called Patton, in which it was the story of General Patton and his war. And I remember in one scene he goes to the top of a hill after a tank battle and he sees below the tanks smouldering and the dead and the debris. And he takes a great sigh and he looks to heaven and says, "Forgive me, God, but I love it." And I suppose there's a lot of that in every war correspondent's blood. You go because you enjoy it. It's a hateful thing to have to admit. And one would be hated for saying it. I'm sure anyone listening to me would be very upset to think that I liked going to war. I don't like war. Only a maniac would like war. But the going to war and the reporting of it is very exciting. It's very exhilarating. I often said that one of the things I feared most about war was not being sent to it. There is a sense of masochism and a sense of being a warrior. I mean, all men, especially all young men, have that warrior in their blood, don't they? It's like being a soldier with being on better pay. Again, I wrote an autobiography in which I entitled it A Measure of Danger, and I drew that from Graham Greene, one of Graham Greene's book, in which he talked about the privilege of going to war, but having the one-way ticket out. You experienced just that measure of danger that was comfortable. When it got too uncomfortable, you could actually get out of it, unlike the people fighting it and the people suffering from it. Do remember that most of the time, in the Gulf and the Falklands perhaps was one of the two exceptions, most of the time you go to a place only for a short while, you report, and then you come up with all the glory of having reported it. And you have that one-way ticket out. A few places like Sarajevo, difficult, because once you were in, you were in, and you suffered like all the others in that siege. I think that's possibly why so many reporters suffered like me, some kind of emotional relapse, in that you saw them suffering at first hand and were like them, stuck in the siege. There's the going up the road, and I think once you've gone up the road, that's a bit of slang we use in our trade for going to war, going up the road. Once you've gone up the road, you're obliged to go up again, because how can you refuse not to? How can you tell your boss that you don't want to do it anymore? I remember in the Falklands there was one correspondent there. I won't say who he was or who he worked for. But on our first attack, when we were under attack, was found sheltering in a corner, crouched like a frightened dog. And he was fazed, and he had to be sent home. I remember once in Amman, when we were in that hotel, the Intercon, with the Bedouin on one side and the Palestinians, and they were actually firing through the hotel. Every piece of glass was shattered. You couldn't move at times. You just had to lie on the floor with your head down. And on one occasion, after one such morning, I was with my cameraman somewhere, and suddenly an American came and said, "Hey, you've got to come down. Your guy's in a bad way." We went down, and our sound recordist was there, and he was being held, restrained. I said, "What's going on?" He said, he wants to leave. And I said to this fellow, I said, well, what's the problem? Oh, I can't mention his name. He said, "Well, I want to leave. I want to get a taxi. I want to leave here. There's a taxi out there. I want to go to Damascus." I said, "There are no taxis out there. There's nothing out there." "Yes, there is. I want to leave." And I said, "You come with us. We'll get a taxi. You come downstairs for a while. We'll order a taxi for you." And we went down into the cellar, gave him water and chocolate to eat and nuts, and we sat down. There were women and children for about a week before we could actually lift them all out. But you never know how it's going to hit you. They are the exceptions. People don't know what it's like to be under constant constant fire. I remember again in Cyprus at the time when I think my almost broke. You know, it's one thing to be at the end of indiscriminate fire, especially artillery, because you know they're not aiming at you, and you know, you stand as much chance as anyone as being hit or escaping it. Odd thing about artillery fire, though, it's frightening, and mortar fire is frightening. You know it's indiscriminate, and you just keep your fingers crossed and hope that you keep your head down. But in Cyprus, I think I related to you earlier, when we were ambushed and somebody, we had to leave the car, and I ran down into a little culvert, and suddenly a sniper started firing at me. I'm sure I told you this. And every time I moved, he fired and it landed a yard or so away, or just over my head. And I thought, it was only when I moved, so he was always having a game. He wasn't trying to kill me. But every time I tried to call, I could see a kind of little bit of protection. Every time I tried to call, he fired again. And I thought, this man has his eye on me. I'm in the sniper's sight. And he can kill me at any minute he likes. He may just be playing games, and then he'll kill me. And I must say, I reached a point there where I thought, I'm either going to die from his bullet, or I'm going to die from stroke. I was there for about 2 hours, couldn't move. And it was boiling, boiling hot. And eventually I was rescued by two British soldiers. But the times like that, you think, well, after this, I don't think I'll do it again. But, you know, one's memory is very short. You know, an hour later, I was probably laughing and saying how brave I was. And like all dreadful things, the memory is a great healer. Mm-hmm. And it filters out the terror you felt at the time. And you only feel terribly brave and proud of yourself in retrospect. I think that helps. But I've enjoyed it. I wouldn't have missed any minute of it for anything. But of course, I can afford to say that because I'm sitting here comfortably in my own house, which has been paid for because I had the job I had, and I've survived it. I have covered more wars than anyone living in this world. I'm here to tell the tales.
You've also been there at the cutting edge of history, haven't you? So many of these wars are now so interesting historically.
Well, I often give little talks to schools around here. I gave two in the last 2 weeks. One in my son William's old school, and the other one was at Natasha's school. And of course, you're talking about wars that are totally, well, to coin a phrase, foreign to these children. You know, 16, 18-year-old kids, and they weren't even alive at my last war, with the exception, I suppose, of Bosnia, but they certainly weren't alive during the Falklands or the Gulf War. And the Bosnian War, they were only, you know, 7, 6 years old. They don't remember that. So I might just as well be talking about Trafalgar or Waterloo or the Battle of Hastings. To them, these are historical wars. To me, they're still very vivid. And you know, my first war was in 68, and it's now the year 2002. some of those early wars almost seem like Trafalgar to me.
It's a privilege though, isn't it?
First draft of history. They say that journalism is writing the first draft of history. And sounds a cliche, but one is privileged to have been a witness to these things. Sad that we have. I have to say that, you know, when you first start your career as a young reporter, I suppose there is at the back of your mind the feeling that what you write, what you report, what you film will somehow help to make the world better. I suppose it's a bit like a doctor. That's why a young man becomes a doctor, that somehow along the line he's going to make the world healthier, better, keep people alive. And I think a reporter feels that way too, that the more you can broadcast things, the more people take notice, and the less chance, the fewer the risk that things will get, let's put it the other way, the thing, because of what you say and write and report, things will get better, because people will be so outraged at what they see and hear, they'll make things better. But at the end of a career, when you start to hang up your boots, you realise that you've done nothing of the kind. All you've done is to advertise the world's ills and outrages and done nothing to cure them. It's a sad epitaph for a career, but I think it's the only one that fits.